Life's better with American Family Insurance because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Welcome to another episode of Higher Education, a weekly consultation on all things climbing related. I'm your host, Andy Kirkpatrick. You're going to have to, I apologise, you might be able to pick up a kind of weird noise, like a but it's my next door neighbour, who I think is actually having some kind of nervous breakdown because he just spends a lot of time on his turbo at the moment. That's not a small thing that goes into like a sports car, but actually a bike turbo, you know, where you stand on a, sit on a bike and you go around in your living room. Or you don't go around, you just stay in the same place. He was doing it this morning at like 4:30 in the morning. He was on his fucking turbo. And I would go around there and like tell him to stop it, but he's like pretty fit. Like he spends his whole time on his turbo, so I'll just ignore it. So if you can hear it in the background, see if you can hear it. There's also, that's a car beeping. Anyway, hopefully you can't hear it. I'll just keep speaking over it. So it's gonna go faster now. I bet you can hear, you probably can hear me. So I was thinking, actually, I should explain who I am. Someone told me today how his wife was listening to this podcast, even though she wasn't a climber, and she was very interested in prussic loops, even though she didn't know what prussic loop was. So I better kind of explain like who I am. So my name's Andy Kirkpatrick, and I won't go into the whole autobiographical details, but I come from the UK. I'm a climber type person. I've been climbing since I was 5 years old. I've got to get out of this habit of speaking like her, like an Australian, and everything sounds like it's a question. Anyway, so I've been climbing since about 5 years old. I always sort of see myself as a mountaineer. And the first kind of proper climbing I did was climbing like in the Alps. I only ever climbed in the Alps in the winter time for some reason. So I've done like lots of like hard route, like, you know, North Face kind of things in the Alps, the Drew and the Duats and all that kind of stuff. Been to Patagonia like 5 times, always in the winter for some reason. Been to Alaska in the winter, Antarctica, Greenland, all those kind of places. But I'm mainly known as being a big wall climber, really. I've kind of got pigeonholed as that, really. Like if you go and do a like a climbing festival or whatever, people are always like, oh, there's no big wall routes around here, or there's no aid climbing. Like, I'm not actually like aid climbing. It's just something, like I did the Drew Couloir on the backside of the, around the side of the Drew, and it had like an aid pitch on it. And I was like so terrible at it, I thought like, oh, I need to learn how to do aid climbing. So I ended up going to Yosemite and climbing El Cap. I ended up climbing El Cap like 35 times, and I've soloed it like 5 times and climbed it in a day and all that kind of stuff, but not on the same trip. So it seems I've got like pigeonholed as being an aid climber, but I always see myself more as a mountaineer. And I've climbed a lot in the winter, like ice climbing, mixed climbing, sort of climbed like Scottish grade eights and things. And But what I'm really not amazing at is rock climbing. I used to work in a shop where everyone was climbing like E7 and E8 and harder. So I always felt like I was a really shit rock climber. But I've always been climbing the same grade, which is sort of 5'10", which kind of in the UK goes from about hard VS to E3, depending on how much I've been climbing. So I kind of have a unique you know, unique ability to be like an average climber who's kind of climbed like, you know, like routes which aren't kind of average. So I've like done like new routes in, you know, like Antarctica, like, you know, big walls, which like super hard climbers have done. And I've managed to do new routes and, you know, soloed like routes that really good climbers would solo. And anyway, so I don't know why. Someone said what I should do, like my really good thing would be like skiing to the South Pole or crossing Antarctica or rowing across the Atlantic. But they all require like a shitload of money. So I just stuck to climbing and, you know, made something out of that. Often people think I've retired from climbing because I don't actually look like a climber. If you met me, I'd look like I was a builder or something. I've not really got the physique of like some sort of... someone said I'm like a wolf in sheep's clothing, which what he really meant was I'm a big fat bastard who's actually quite good at climbing. Also, someone said I was like a bumblebee in that I look like I shouldn't be able to fly, but I can. And but really, my what I'm really good at is not dying. That's, you know, I don't want to like jinx myself. But anyway, I'm kind of good at suffering. So usually, like if it's really really good conditions and it's like brilliant climbing, then you know Adam Ondra's gonna be much better than me. But you know, but if it was like raining and snowing and we'd not had any food for like, you know, a week and we'd not had any water and we both had, you know, then I'd probably be better than him, you know. So, you know, fingers crossed one day that'll happen. So I am still climbing, climbed probably like every other day last year, like climbed, spent like 3 months in Australia climbing and blah, blah. I don't want to sound like I'm like blowing on trumpet, but I am actually still climbing. The last big thing I did, tried to climb Denali last winter in February, and got up to camp 5 and we ran out of food and it was really exciting, minus 50 and all that kind of rubbish. And currently living in the Middle East, which is very flat. So there's not much climbing here. That's why I probably doing this podcast so I can talk about it. So that's who I am. So if anybody wants to know, I'll just get them to listen to this bit of the podcast. And I make a living, at the moment I make a living writing and doing all sorts of weird work, like an assassin and that kind of stuff. You always have to be careful, really, because I used to tell people I was an assassin. And then one day I actually met a real assassin. And that's another story. So I've got a mixed bag of questions this week. So all this podcast is called Cycle Vertical. This is higher education. This is like a little subset of podcasts where I just answer really inane questions. I was going to talk about lanyards this week, I've got quite a few questions this week. So I actually have a lot of questions, but I can't find them all because you get these days in the old days, you know, you just get a, you know, handwritten telegram. You just get an email and you could just have all your emails. But now you've got like Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and, you know, and like unverified things. And so you just got all these things everywhere. So this is like, it's like a mixed bag of questions and I'll kind of go through them. So the first one is, hi, Andy, we're planning on climbing the nose in a 3-man team. The leader will have ladders, which are aid climbing things like aiders, but we are considering for the second and third climber to ascend the rope using Yates stirrups. Would that make sense? There are a few traverses and the stirrups are fiddly to use on traverses, but all doable. I cannot think of any other disadvantage, but I was hoping you could tell me. So basically, if you're going to climb a big wall, like I wrote this book last year, Higher Education, which is almost like an autistic person's big wall book in that it's like covers every single thing you could ever want to know about big wall climbing. And a lot of stuff you wouldn't want to know. Like it goes to such minute detail, it even includes the weight and the volume of shit a human being produces. It's actually quite important. If you're going to do like a wall and you're going to be on it for like 2 weeks and there's like 4 of you, you need to kind of calculate how much shit you're going to produce because you're going to have to carry it with you up the wall. When I wrote this book, I kind of just wrote it over like a year. And I just like, and I climbed El Cap about five times while I was writing it. So it just kept getting, every time I'd climb it, I would think of more things. I just keep adding it. And then I created the document and then it was like printed. So people could buy it. And, but I couldn't, I never actually saw the book until I was away. And then when I came back, you know, I got a copy of my own book and I looked at it and it was like, Christ almighty, this looks like a book that a crazy person would write. Like it really is really, 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 really detailed. So someone said to me the other day, like, oh, you you put all that effort into that book. And then, but basically people don't go aid climbing anymore. So it was a bit of a waste of time. But the thing about big wall climbing is it's actually a growth industry in that, yeah, like even on a lot of really hard aid routes, really hard free climbing routes, people actually aid up the pitches before they actually free them. But basically the book is primarily not so much about the aid climbing. It's more about like hauling, bivouacking, cleaning, you know, alpine walls and all that kind of stuff. So these guys, so usually when you're doing a big wall like the Nose and El Cap, for that you can have a system where you only have one daisy chain or one like lanyard, which is like the thing that's going to connect you in, and one aider, which is like a nylon ladder. And that's quite a good system. And you can have variations of it where the ladder is attached to a fifi hook. And that fifi hook is attached to you with some like strong cord. And it means that you can hook it onto a piece of gear, do the move. And if you're like going into a free climbing move, the aid just is lifted off as you climb above it, which is a like European sort of style, you know, like old fashioned Dolomites kind of technique, which actually works really well for like very like mixed climbing. Because on the Nose, a lot of it, you can free climb it. Or it's like really easy aiding, really. And often you want to be able to like suddenly go from like standing in an aider to standing on a foothold to grabbing hold of a cam. And that's the way you kind of climb it quickly. But most people don't generally have two lanyards, two adjustable lanyards, usually like a Petzl, like a Just or something, and two aiders. And it means that they can kind of leapfrog the aiders when they're aid climbing. And when they're dew marring, because it's not very steep, the Nose. It's steep at the top, but the bottom isn't as very steep. A lot of the time you're actually just standing in your aiders and you're like stepping up on your aiders. You're not actually weighting your harness at all. You kind of, you know, like one of those like stepping machine type things you used to get. Like you're just like going up a ladder, really. So it's really important to have two aiders. If you only got one aider, like it's, you know, it's like you waste a lot of energy. So he's like saying, is it worth the other people having this thing that Yates make? Like Yates make basically like industrial gear and like big wall gear. And they have a thing, it's like a foot loop on the bottom, and then it's an adjustable foot loop. So you've got this like bit your foot goes into that's actually, you can strap your foot in so your foot doesn't come out. And then it goes up into like an adjustable length sling. So you can just like fine tune it. And it hasn't got all these steps which you can get in the way and stuff, and you can just adjust it as you're actually going up on the things, and not having your foot coming out is kind of handy when you're first starting out. How you stop your foot coming out of an aider generally is some aiders, like the normal ladder aiders that Aids make, I think they're called easy aiders, are quite good in that they have like a piece of elastic that's underneath the step. So when you're standing in the step, you can put the elastic around your foot and it keeps it in. But once you get into dew marring, you generally, what you do is you're moving the aider up and the dew mar, you just keep a tiny little bit of weight on the aider, so it stops. So you're kind of lifting your foot up with your handle a little tiny little bit. So it keeps your foot in the aider. But you know, if you climb El Cap, by the time you get to the top, you're quite good at all this kind of stuff. But it's always good, like someone is always going to drop something. So I would say that if you're in a team of three, basically one person climbs, up the lead line, taking all the gear out, and the other person climbs up the whole line, and then the whole bag's lowered out and it's hauled up. So the person going up the whole line, they don't really need like full size, don't really need aiders. So the foot loop is quite good. You can just make a foot loop out of some webbing if you want, really. But it's always good to have like two sets of aiders, because if you drop an aider, then you can just like send up one of the other aiders. So like always, you always want some kind of redundancy. So hopefully I answered that question. So here's another one. This is like a clothing type one. Hi, Andy. I know you get tons of gear questions, but just wondering what your thoughts are on Polartec Alpha Direct tops compared to the old style Pyrpertex garments or Micropile, i.e. dry climb, vaporize, etc. All the best, James. So I've written a few articles on my website about soft shell, and the original kind of the original proper soft shell, I would say, was like the Buffalo Mountain shirt, which was a piece of clothing, still exists. It's a piece of clothing that came out in the 90s by a guy called Hamish Hamilton, who also designed the Van Gogh Force 10. And Hamish was like an absolute genius guy, like really, like probably one of the most interesting people I've met. Like he was just, he just like totally came at this idea of staying comfortable, completely different to everybody else. And he basically, I think he'd been living in Baffin Island or something. I think he was in the RAF. He was like a radar operator. And I think he'd seen Inuits. And now how an Inuit would wear clothing, you know, because an Inuit's like in a very tough environment, like staying comfortable in like really cold temperatures is really, really easy. Like it's actually really easy to stay warm at like minus 50, more so than it is at like, you know, minus 5 or plus 5. But the Inuits, they actually wear like very thick clothing with nothing underneath. And basically, as soon as they had to do anything really physical, like run around or whatever, they would like almost like strip off so they could just dump all this heat out. Where this kind of European kind of idea, where you had all these like layers and layers and layers of like wool and cotton and, you know, gabardine and all these kind of fabrics, that was very hard to like dump the moisture. So a lot of, I tend to find the reason why a lot of people get really cold and hypothermic in the mountains is not because they haven't got enough clothes on. It's because they've got too many clothes on and the clothes just become like totally saturated. So Hamish like basically used fiber pile. So fiber pile is not the same as fleece. So fiber pile, and it's got like, because it's like a fur, like the actual tips of the fiber pile, when they touch your skin, you've actually got like something with a very large surface area with a very small contact. It's like surface contact to your skin. So with fiber pile, if you get like a piece of fiber pile and you get it completely soaking wet and then put a fiber pile jacket on, if it's tight, then the actual tips of the pile will dry almost like instantaneously, but the actual body of the pile is still like soaking wet. Like it'll feel totally dry, but if you like lean against something, all the water will just like appear in it. So, and because your skin's dry, it's warmer, and then that heat ends up like pushing the water, the moisture out of the fiber pile onto the larger surface area. And then what he did was he actually found this material called Pertex. And Pertex is actually made by the same people who used to make the ribbon for typewriters. Because a ribbon for a typewriter, you know, it just has one small piece of ink that is like spread through capillary action throughout the whole, you know, through the whole ribbon. So basically by covering this fiber pile with ribbon, you know, like a bigger version of like the ribbon from a typewriter, as soon as the moisture came close to it, it would just like spread out all the way across the fabric. So the fabric would dry like incredibly quickly. So I think the Buffalo shirt was the first. I think originally he came up with this material because he used it on the inners of tents for Van Gogh, and people just didn't really get it. And then he used it on the Buffalo clothing. And I would still say, like when we're on Denali this year, you know, you're up there for, I think we're up there for like over a month, you know, in like really difficult, you know, stormy weather, you know, living in a snow hole the entire time. And basically we were wearing a montane extreme kind of clothing, which is just basically like Buffalo clothing, really. with some like slight differences. And I would still say like the buffalo clothing, because it's actually designed to be super simple. It's got very few, anything that's going to hold moisture. So it doesn't have like reinforcing patches which hold moisture or anything. That's super, super lightweight, is still probably one of the best like high altitude, you know, cold weather clothing you can buy. Like the high altitude Solopets have a zipper that goes like through the legs. You know, it just is really easy to dump the heat on that kind of clothing. But a lot of people in it, but it looks shit. That's his biggest problem. It looks like shit, and so people don't want to look shit. And because the main buffalo shirt like goes over your head, it's like a pullover. You know, it's, if you're in the pub, you know, you look a bit weird. And some, like it used to be, but it used to be like a, there was like a bit of a esprit de corps for people who wore buffalo, and, you know, like Doug Scott and Wojtek Kurtiker, and, you know, a lot of like really good climbers actually wore buffalo because it just worked so well. And they might have wear like, you know, Berghaus, you know, super expensive jacket over the top, but it was actually like buffalo underneath. And, but like Pat, so I wear, I think I always keep mentioning this for some reason, but I work for Patagonia as they had like some like five gear testers, and I worked for Patagonia for a while. And when I was working for them, I helped sort of developed the first, because one of the first like a buffalo-esque piece of clothing for Patagonia. And I think the original jacket was, I think they called it like the Inferno, which was a kind of a bastardized version of it. It was like a, it was almost like a jacket like you'd wear in the car, really. It was like long, you know, had a big hood and all that kind of stuff. And then they kind of slowly tweaked it. And I think it was called, the Ascent or something? It was actually a really good jacket. They came up with a really, really good jacket. Like people like Steve House and people like that, like really, really liked it. There was like a yellow and gray one. There was like a blue one earlier on. And that was like a really, really good, really good version of the jacket that worked super, super well. And with like, with all things, the Patagonia and these kind of people, you know, you end up with a really, really good product, and then it goes for like two seasons and then it just disappears. So, but probably one of the best soft shell products is still around, which is the Marmot Dry Climb Vaporize kind of jacket, which I'm sure lots of people have used or had. And kind of a variation of that is the Rab kind of vaporize kind of jacket. And there was a few other people make, I think Montaigne were making one like that. And basically it's one of the best, remains one of the best bits of clothing that exists. But again, it looks a bit shit. So, you know, brands, you know, like drop it or whatever. But the Rab one is really good. I'm not really up on what's around at the moment. So I'm not actually sponsored by any clothing companies. So when I say this, I'm not like promoting any brands. I'm just telling you like what I think. As Patagonia were like, I think, I don't know if Patagonia came up with the term soft shell, like Hamish called his like double P, which was Pile Pertex. But I suspect like Patagonia probably came up with a soft shell kind of idea. And although there were, before that, there was a few of these membraned Gore and Polartec and variation Duofold, like windproof fleeces. And they kind of like jumped in on the bandwagon, and you had all these like utterly shit kind of items of clothing which were saying they were like soft shell, which they weren't really. Because as soon as you put like a membrane, like fleece is just a non-starter, really. For performance clothing, I think it's like not a non-starter, really. It has to have like a sort of pile kind of construction, not a fleece construction. So she had all these like really shit like things that are supposed to be soft shell, but as soon as you have a membrane in there, it's not going to work. Basically, like if you make a shirt out of like newspaper, it'll be rubbish. It's made out of newspaper, but you'll realize that the sweat, even though it's newspaper, which is kind of breathable, the sweat won't be able to get through it quick enough, and it'll just get wet. So that's why a lot of these soft shell, basically it's soft shell as in if you're like, you know, if you're delivering pizzas, you know, and you get out of your car and you have to go to someone's door, you know, it'll keep the wind out and it might even keep some like wetness out. But if you're going out on a mountain, it's a complete waste of time. So don't, you know. So Patagonia and Polartec, they came up with like those, like the R1 fleece and the R2 fleece and the R3 fleece, which were probably the point where they dropped the complete soft shell kind of system, and they introduced, you know, they introduced this like a more of a layering system. So, you know, because that kind of R1 sort of fleece, you know, is kind of cross between a fleece and a pile. It actually works quite well. So if you've got like a Patagonia R1 pullover and you have a Pertex wind shell over the top of it, you find that it actually works, you know, works quite well. And if you have a, you know, so I'm sure lots of people have like used this kind of stuff. So you know what I'm talking about. So, but the next kind of, I don't know if I call it a revolution because I've not actually ever used any, but the Polartec or Alpha Direct tops are, it's, you know, you've got two layers of material, sort of breathable material, and you've got this very lofty sort of synthetic kind of, you know, like a puff kind of insulation, but it's kind of spread out quite a lot. It's got a lot of space for moisture to pass through it. And that does look like it works quite well. The only thing I'd question was how robust it is, how long it would last before it starts thinning out. Like the thing about fiber pile is, like I used to have a Javelin, like fiber pile jacket, and the same with like some of the old Patagonia fiber pile jackets, which are from like the 1970s, like they still work probably as well, you know, like 40 years on, they're still, you know, 30, 40, is that 50 years? Anyway, 40 years on, they're still working the same. Where I doubt a Polartec Alpha Direct jacket is going to be still working after 10 years. So I was arguing with someone today about the use of the word eco in clothing advertising, and it's a little bit like the word luxury. You can't really define what it is, although luxury is the absence of vulgarity. But eco is a, I said it was a bit like the MSG of like marketing. You just sprinkle it on some product, and you know, basically all the sweatshop workers in Vietnam were all wearing clogs. Therefore, it's an eco product, but. The most important element of a product to be eco is that it lasts a long time. Like ideally, it lasts forever, as in it lasts for the lifetime of the person. So, you know, if you're buying a lightweight rucksack that, you know, weighs like 500 grams, but it's made out of like, you know, silk or something, you know, it's gonna last you 1 year or 2 years. But if you buy a sack made out of like ballistic nylon, which is you know, it's like a third heavier, it will probably last you for like the whole of your life. Like this, the straps will eventually like get a lot thinner, but there is a way you could design a sack which would last you, you know, for the whole of your life. So that's like an element I think you should take into account. But the upside of the Polartec Alpha is it's going to be a lot less bulky, because that's the problem with the fiber pile, is it's like really, really bulky. It's good if you do a trip where you put it on and you don't take it off for a month. But if you're having to like take it on and off and, you know, it's getting hot and cold and things, it doesn't work as well as like a more traditional kind of layering system. But when you want it to work, it's going to work better than anything else. Another clothing question. It was actually someone asking me, it was a long email. It was about winter trousers advice. So basically waterproof trouser advice. So I would say if it comes to waterproof trousers, that pretty much they're all, to a degree, they're all the same. Like nearly all of them are made out of Gore-Tex these days. And they're all basically the same kind of Gore-Tex. Yeah, it might be Pro this or whatever, or, you know, Shite Text this, but it's basically they're all going to perform pretty much the same, and all of them are going to get ripped by crampons or ripped when you like fall over and you're sliding down your ass. In the past, you could buy waterproof trousers which were made out of like Tazlan, you know, Gore-Tex Tazlan, which was a super, super tough version of Gore-Tex. Like, it was kind of it wasn't indestructible, it was pretty indestructible. And people would still keep wearing them, even when the Gore-Tex had stopped working. And the last ones I saw like that, I think Mountain Hardware made some like super, like, industrial strength trousers. And they were pretty good. And a few people do come out with, you know, trousers which are kind of designed for like guides. So like Mammut might have some, you know, like designed to be, but they're so tough that it's actually quite hard to sell them. It's like tough to sell them because people are always obsessed with lightweight stuff, because a lot of people aren't wearing waterproof trousers. They're wearing like soft shell, you know, like soft shell as in like shoulder kind of stretch, you know, windproof stretch kind of trousers. So only in Scandinavia, people wear, for some reason, they wear the waterproof trousers the whole time. You know, when you're setting off and it's dry, they've got the waterproof trousers on, which is a bit weird. So, but even then, they're all kind of much of a muchness, I think. And I would just, because they're so, like, I probably get through like one pair of waterproof trousers a year, and I always like, I repair them. I use like seam grip, and I try and like, you know, like the best bit gets so holy that it's kind of not worth repairing them anymore. But I tend to get ones which are light enough that I can carry them in my bag without having to worry about it too much. And I'll only put them on when it's like pretty bad. And I'll try and wear trousers. I often wear like sort of Pertex trousers, which dry super quickly. And I'll wear them over like Brynja, like mesh underwear, which doesn't matter if it gets wet because it's mainly air. But if you were doing some, like, I actually, the last pair of trousers I bought were actually German army trousers, which are Gore-Tex, and they're super tough, and they cost about 35 quid. And like the amount of testing and the amount of thought that goes into like German army kit, like, it's a bit weird I'm telling you about buying army surplus kit, but it's actually, I would highly recommend, like, if you can buy a pair offline, buy them like a little bit bigger than you think, because they're only 35 quid, and they're actually really, really good. And they actually look quite cool because they're like a weird kind of German army pattern. I probably won't buy any British army ones. They're probably crap. Another bit of clothing I've actually bought in the past, speaking of army surplus stuff, is they have this cold weather kind of layering system like the US military. And they actually do like a really good fleece, and they actually do a really good synthetic like Das Parka and like Das Parka kind of synthetic trousers, which are like a belaying, you know, extreme cold kind of layer. They're not for like normal climbing, and they do like a waistcoat as well. Unfortunately, it's all green or like a grey color. But it's if you're a bit skin, I suspect that some bits that might be made, like in the past, like people like Wild Things and Patagonia and people like that have made stuff for the US military. So you can actually get some quite good deals, really. If someone asked me like, what are the best waterproof trousers you can buy? Like, if you were living somewhere where it was like raining the entire time, and you know, like living in like Ireland or, you know, some sort of Scandinavian country, I would probably say Paramo trousers, which is, if some people won't know what Paramo is, but it's basically like a version of, like, I think Hamish Hamilton and the guy from Paramo, they actually had some dealings at the beginning of Paramo, and they went in different directions. But it's basically this sort of slight pile, very micro pile fabric with a like windproof, very breathable, water resistant outer to it. And, you know, Paramo is like, works really, really well. And the only reason I'm not like super keen on it personally is that it is a little bit heavy. So, but it's ideal for people who want to put the waterproof trousers on in the morning and like wear them all day long. So yeah. So Paramo is worth checking out. So final question. He's still on his turbo, so I'll just get this one. So all right. So it's, hi Andy, hope you're well. I was wondering if you might do a podcast about extra measures or precautions you can take if there's a big difference in weight between you and your partner, and in brackets he wrote, climbing, not in the bedroom. Although thinking about this, it would be quite a funny subject. I don't know anything about having sex with someone who's a different size to me. I shouldn't say that, because my wife will think, I think she's a big fat bastard. Getting the perfect partner requires compromises, so this is probably an issue for quite a lot of climbers. Thanks, Matt. Please don't tell anybody my first name. Okay, Matt. So, it's a tricky one. You do see people climbing and you're like, God, if that guy falls off, that woman's just going to get, like, it's generally men and women. It's not usually the woman who's like a giant and the man's like a tiny person, unless he drinks a lot of soya milk. The most obvious thing is like, don't fall off. A lot of trad climbers don't fall off. And then when they do fall off, they generally kind of shocked, like what happens. I remember once doing a route, is it Left Unconquerable on Stanage? And I was climbing up there. This friend of mine, Jez, who is like, he must have weighed like, you know, like 7 stone or something. And I probably weighed like 12 stone. I was quite thin then. And I was like laybacking up the thing. And I think I had like a cam in, and then I put another cam in, and I was right near the top. And I reached up into where the handhold was, and it was full of water, and my hand just like slipped off and I fell, and like Jez just came like flying up, and we ended up like literally like eye to eye with each other. Like he was halfway at the wall. But usually you don't really find out. So the first thing is if you're climbing with someone who's lighter than you, they have to wear a helmet, because the chances are that if you don't do things properly, then they're probably going to go like flying either into the wall or up the wall. And if they hit something while they're going into the wall or up the wall, there's a good chance they're going to like let go of the rope, and then you'll both basically come back down again. So it's that's not good. So wear a helmet. Consider like anchoring the person to the wall, like even if it's a single pitch route or whatever, like try and set up a belay where they're safe. There's a device called an Edelrid OHM or OM, which I'm sure you've probably checked out already, where the rope runs through it. And it's basically like a bit like a cleat, I think, in that you clip it to the first bolt. And if you fall, then the arm like takes up a lot of the friction, and it stops the person from being pulled up. But that's really only, it's only, unless you're going to do like trad routes on a single rope, which I don't tend to recommend. I think you're always best with a double rope. Then it's like only really good for sport climbing or climbing. If you're climbing indoors, like you should really get one of these things. If you're climbing indoors, you can always like make sure the wall has got a points to clip into the floor, or like bags, you know, weight bags, you know, which work quite well. So what if you're trad climbing, and I think when you're trad climbing, if you've got two ropes, I think you tend to actually, I think the weight is actually not quite so bad, because is it being spread over two ropes or two anchors, two runners when you fall off? I don't know. Maybe I seem to think it's not as bad as when you've got a single rope. There's more the impact force is lower, because it has the ropes stretch more, so it has more time to absorb the weight of you falling. But even then, you're probably going to get pulled up. But probably the best advice, if you're going to do like trad climbing, is actually just to do like a direct belay, either using a munter hitch, like an Italian hitch, if you've got two ropes, or you can just like clip the belay device like straight into the belay. So basically, you build your belay. And you know, like when you use a guided belay device and you're bringing someone up, it's like clip direct into the belay. You just do that. So the belay, you got it in belay mode, and you're belaying the leader, but the belay device is actually attached to the anchor, and then you're attached to the anchor as well. And you need to have the anchor so it's good for an upward pull. It has to be good for an upward pull. So the classic case would be, you know, if you were doing like kind of a route with like bolt belays that's kind of semi-trad, you know, you would just you kind of clip into both bolts, and then you would have the belay device clipped into the one of the bolts, so you're directly onto that bolt, backed up to the other bolt, and you're backed into both bolts, and you would just feed the rope out like that. And it actually works really, really well. Like if you climb with like German climbers, Austrian climbers, those kind of people, they, not so much nowadays, but in the past, they always used the belay off of like a Munter hitch. And the Munter hitch is not going to twist your rope as long as you know how to use it properly. And it's not going to twist your rope if you're not, you know, if you're not like loading it. So it has a lot of advantages. So it's something you should play around with. The final thing you should do is get the belay to wear some kind of gloves, which is a good idea, like leather gloves. They're very sexy. And also, you know, like some kind of, if you're going to belay like off your harness, like indirectly, is that indirectly? Yeah, indirectly. Can't think. Is that an indirect belay? I can't remember now. Anyway, so if you're going to belay off your harness, then it might also be worth considering using some kind of auto-locking belay device, either like a gree-gree, or if you're using double ropes, like some other kind of double rope locking device, because there is that, you know, when you're being like accelerated upwards into the wall, there's a good chance that people actually do let go of the rope and like put their hands out to protect themselves. Depends how much they love you. So yes, I had one last question from Dave. This was from YouTube. God, I sound like a professional, don't I? Dear from YouTube. Usually people on YouTube just say like something like really, really bizarre. So I went climbing with Alex Jones, and a lot of people actually thought it was the other Alex Jones, but it wasn't. It was the Alex Jones. So this was a question of, is it worth using a prussic backup when rappelling with a gree-gree? Because if you let go of the gree-gree, it's going to lock up automatically. Now, this is one of these questions where if you asked it on a forum, people would be like, oh, what a stupid question. Like, of course you don't need to use it, blah, 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 blah. So it kind of depends. It's like, oh, like people have died on El Cap, for example, where they went to rappel and the gree-gree wasn't clipped into their harness. So they just fell, you know, they just went. So although the gree-gree does lock up, it doesn't mean that you're actually clipped to your harness. Where when you use a belay device and use a prussic loop as a backup, it means that even if your belay device isn't clipped into your harness, you're not going to die. So I have used a gree-gree a lot for abseiling and things when you're on a big wall. And I tend to be very careful when I'm just using a gree-gree, because I tend to always use a backup when I'm using a belay device. And I tend to prefer to just use my belay device to rappel on. But if I am using a gree-gree, sometimes it's easy to like rappel down on your gree-gree and then just kind of like, you know, use one juma on the gree-gree to go back up again. If you're just going up and down really quickly. But if it was dark, or I wasn't really sure what I was doing, or if it was like bad weather, or there was a reason where there's a chance where I could like make a mistake and not have I think if you listen to my second podcast, which is called like How Not to Kill Yourself or Staying Alive or something, is, you know, twice in my life I've actually abseiled on a you know, significant drop where the carabiner wasn't actually clipped to my harness. It was just kind of semi-hooked onto the belay loop, you know, and the gate was open, and somehow it stayed on. So, yeah, so I don't think it's that such a daft question. Like, if you're going to use it with a gree-gree, you'd probably have to put the prussic loop on your leg, or you'd have to have the prussic loop, extended a little bit. Because you can't really extend a gree-gree. It has to really kind of be on your belay loop. So the prussic would have to be above, but... It's not as daft as it sounds really when you're abseiling over the top of El Cap and it's a 1,000 meter drop, although you know that you should always really have two points of contact into the rope, and the gree-gree is the one thing where it often like breaks that kind of rule. So having like two points is probably not, you know, really stupid. Because, like, you know, a gree-gree, like, I've seen one gree-gree where it basically got, like, twisted in a weird way and the thing broke off where the rope goes through it. So the clipping sort of point broke off it. So, you know, like, you know, these things can happen. And also, I will admit that several times I've abseiled on a greegreen and had the rope through the wrong way around, which is kind of worrying when you kind of realise when it's too late. So just having that extra point is a good idea. You know, like if you had it above the greegree, then that gives you that tiny little chance that if you were to abseil off your rope, that prusik would might stop you if you didn't grab hold of it and pull it down with you. So anyway, so on that cheery note, I shall sign off and send in your questions. Ideally email me at andy@cyclevertical.com. Share this podcast, blah, 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 and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, I shall do another podcast Thursday, maybe. Okay, bye. Someday.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.